London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. Today we bring you an authentic note on Scottish cookery, a report on the crumbling pinnacle of Salisbury Cathedral, and we take you to an American university in Britain.
We'll go there now, in fact.
The University of Maryland has come to Britain, setting up two colleges, one at Ruislip near London, the other at Burtonwood in Lancashire. Both of these colleges are for members of the United States Air Force and for civilians attached to it, and any of these who care to can devote 4 nights a week in their off-duty period to higher education. Well, Burtonwood in Lancashire is a major American Air Force base, and on the occasion of the first lecture to some 160 USAF students, our correspondent Charles Gardner called in and found out from the Burtonwood Education Officer, Captain Beecham, that although new to England, Germany already has 22 of these American colleges.
That is correct. We have one here at Burtonwood, a center at Burtonwood, and a center at Ruislip, that's in London.
Both of them opening tonight.
Both of them open tonight in the UK, yes.
And these wide university facility which the USAF is laying on for its personnel extend all over the area where the United States Air Force happens to be. I mean, in Japan and in America as well, and here in England and in Europe now.
Yes, at the present time, there are 12 universities in the States that have a similar program. University of California has a program set up in Tokyo in the Far East, and the University of Maryland, of course, is the largest, and they're set up here in Europe.
So, in fact, the people who, officers and men who care to enroll on this course here, do become real students of the University of Maryland, although many thousands of miles away.
That is correct. You might say that the University of Maryland has transplanted itself from College Park in Maryland to Burtonwood.
That this university college was the proper completion of an entire educational structure now established at the base was pointed out by the commanding officer of the Burtonwood Air Base Wing, Colonel McNabb.
We're very pleased to have a university. We've been looking forward to the University of Maryland coming here and setting up facilities to provide higher education for our personnel on this base. We're very pleased that they're here tonight, and we welcome Professor and Mrs. Mayer. We hope they will enjoy their stay here. As a matter of fact, the university here will be in addition to our other educational facilities. We have a grade school that provides schooling for our dependent children from the ages of about 6 to 14.
Can I interrupt? How many dependent children have you on the station?
We have approximately 500, I would say.
That's quite a problem.
And it is. Most of them do go to British schools, but some of them live on the post. It's too far to British schools, or the British schools are filled. So we found it necessary to provide education for our children here on the base. Furthermore, we are starting very soon a high school on the base for the older children from the ages of 14 to 18. So we're now in a position to say that in a very short time, a child, if he stays at Burtonwood long enough, could start from the first grade through college and get all his education at one place.
Food for the mind to food of the more ordinary kind. It seems that the Scot coming south to work in England finds his greatest problem of adjustment in his stomach, and that wild Helaman MacDonald Crane, expatriate Scot, thinks it's high time the world appreciated the difference between English and Scottish food.
Only last week I had a breakfast experience down here which upset me as much, if not more, than the defeat of our football team in the annual game between Scotland and England. I admit, one can be a little more sensitive than usual at the breakfast table, but when a waiter comes along and clanks down a plate of steaming grey mush, sprinkled lightly with a few pathetic grains of sugar, and says, "Your porridge, sir," then it's time to show the flag. Porridge is not something to be forced down under the watchful eye of your host. It should be a delightful breakfast experience. It's a simple dish to make, but you must know how. Oatmeal, freshly ground, is what to use. Soak it well the night before in a bowl of fresh, clear spring water, and then bring it to the boil with a liberal pinch of salt, stirring all the time. The porridge is then poured into a wooden bowl and served. Now, this is important.
Served with a separate bowl of cream.
or better still, rich milk with the whisked up yolk of an egg and a good dash of whiskey and a sprinkle of sugar. Now, dip the spoon in the porridge, plunge it into the bowl of cream, and sup it up to the accompaniment of as much audible lip smacking as you desire. Now, that porridge. And don't let's have any more of this humbug we encounter south of our border. Apart from the traditional bacon and egg, which I'll admit is British, there are other delectable Scottish breakfast dishes unknown in England. Smokies, for instance. Small, succulent haddock smoked by the Scottish fishermen in the traditional manner over a smouldering fire of oak chips. They should be done in milk and served with a poached egg. Then there's the Scotch egg, which is not, contrary to the general belief, a very small egg. It's a hard-boiled egg with a jacket of pork sausage meat treated with breadcrumbs on the outside and fried in deep fat. There's that rugged individualist, the Scottish kipper from Loch Fyne, or the Scottish omelette with fresh herring melts and smoked salmon. There are many more, but I think that's enough to establish the supremacy of the Scottish breakfast beyond any shadow of doubt.
Well over 500 years ago, English master builders completed one of the most beautiful cathedrals in Europe, that at Salisbury in the green and rolling county of Wiltshire. Salisbury's single spire is over 400 feet high, a landmark and a skymark for many miles around, the tallest in Britain and the third tallest spire in Europe, in fact. But in five centuries, no major maintenance work has been done on the spire, and with ominous cracks appearing in the towering, tapering stern, repairs are now very urgent indeed. Up into the maze of steel scaffolding high above Salisbury, we sent our reporter Patrick Beach to see how the tricky work was being tackled.
Eventually, I summoned up the courage to scramble out onto the scaffolding. It was only three planks wide. All Salisbury lay spread out below me, the green hill of Old Sarum in the distance. But superb though the view was, I wasn't sorry to turn my back on it to examine the masonry. And then the damage was quite obvious. To fasten the blocks of stone together, the medieval masons had used cramps made of iron. Despite casings of lead, the weather has rusted these cramps and made them swell. Just by the door, I saw one block of stone split clean across by the strain. And in other places, rusty water had run down the masonry and decomposed it. Though there's no danger of the spire itself falling, there is a risk of quite substantial pieces of it crashing down. And so the top 25 feet has to be completely demolished and rebuilt, and the next 35 feet extensively repaired. The spire is built of local Chilmark stone. The whole cathedral came out of a quarry 12 miles from Salisbury. But today the quarry is closed and the site taken over by the Air Ministry, so the new stone will be Clipsham from Rutland, the same as in the new House of Commons. The plain blocks will come ready for use. Those for ornamentation will be dressed in the cathedral's own workshop, and a special non-rusting alloy will be used for the cramps. It's reckoned that it'll take each piece of stone some 25 seconds to make the journey between the summit and the ground. To carry it down the first stage, from the scaffolding down to the top of the square tower, they're going to bolt 50 yards of a 3-foot gauge railway line to the side of the spire. It'll be cushioned on blocks of Jarrah wood, which doesn't split or twist and will not mark the masonry. Oak blocks would make stains that would last for 20 years. Then, to shift the material from the top of the tower down to the floor of the nave, they are this week installing an electric hoist. Meanwhile, they've been making use of a piece of medieval machinery. It's a 13-foot diameter wooden tread wheel. Two men walk inside it, others can help by hauling on the circumference, and with it they can handle a block weighing a quarter of a ton. This treadwheel is not a modern copy, it's the actual one used by the men who built the cathedral 500 years ago.
Now let's come right down to earth again for a postscript from London columnist Alan Melville. Alan.
This is Alan Melville speaking. I'm sure you must occasionally think that we in this country spend a great deal of time, not only in London Column, but generally speaking, dwelling on the glories of the past rather than on the problems of the present. I suppose we do. This extremely small country, Britain I mean, having had the good fortune to be invaded by the Romans some considerable time ago, has now had 2,000 years of building crammed into it. Much of it, until comparatively recent times, very good building. The result being that you can hardly heave a brick without hitting something of interest to architects, antiquarians, tourists, or currently town planners. it would be folly to suggest that buildings are of greater importance than what transpires within them. If the spire of Salisbury Cathedral collapsed tomorrow morning, and by some miracle brought down with it not only the rest of the cathedral, but every other church in the land, men would carry on worshipping God, maybe even more devoutly, shorn of ecclesiastical and architectural distractions. Here, after all, is the University of Maryland pursuing its good work of secular rather than religious instruction thousands of miles away from its classrooms, laboratories, and other university buildings. There's no point in harping on the beauties of a cathedral nave if he who harps is a knave himself. But if we do dwell too much on the architectural gems of our past centuries, it is, I think, because we are genuinely proud of them and because it's unique for so small a country to be blessed with such an abundance of them. And whether you're a religious person or not, there's something eminently satisfying in a town which is architecturally presided over by a cathedral church, as they ought properly to be called. I always think one of the nastiest bits of country is the northern slice of France, going through the Pas-de-Calais, through Arras and Amiens and Beauvais and the rest of it. It's flat, uninteresting, poor, it's mean, it's generously dotted with slag heaps, and two wars partly conducted over and around it haven't helped much. Yet, above each of those dull, unprepossessing towns, there rises a Gothic cathedral of such beauty that it makes you forget the slag heaps and the surrounding meanness. It restores your faith simply by reminding you that man, while capable of enduring existing ugliness and of promoting newer and nastier eyesores, is also capable of erecting to the glory of God something of immense beauty. Those cathedrals tower over their squalid little towns much as though the Church of St. John the Divine in New York had been built in some western mining town with a population, say, of 10,000. In fact, the Church of St. John the Divine must be almost an exact copy of the Cathedral of Amiens. And if you're going to copy anything, how wise to take the Gothic style of architecture as your model. Well, here we are blessed in having many of our original Gothic churches still standing and still in use, Salisbury among them. And when this happens every now and then, they show signs of wear and tear, and spires threaten to topple and foundations start to shake. Well, you can generally rely on people who wouldn't know a nave from a cloister to contribute gladly to the cost of repair. For these, our great cathedral churches are part of our history. And if a spire fell, much more would have gone than bricks and mortar and some old Gothic ornamentations. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, a radio digest produced by Stephen Eckard, presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC.
That was London Column, a transcribed program. And now, may I remind you once again that